Well, welcome, everyone. Thank you. This is John Wenhausen. As Don indicated, thank you for the introduction, Don. I am a consultant to EDUCAUSE and Intranet 2, have been for the last 4 or 5 years or so. And one of the constant refrains over the last 4 or 5 years has been us calling for the United States to have a national broadband plan. Most every other country in the world had a national broadband plan beginning around 10 years ago. But the United States was one of those that did not. And lo and behold, finally, after many years of calling for such an activity and such a report, we now have one. And so what I'm going to try to do quickly here in about 20 minutes is to walk through the many, many recommendations. Actually, I'm only going to skim the surface of the National Broadband Plan. It's actually a very, very rich document with many different recommendations across the board. It's impossible to try to summarize all of that activity in a short presentation like this. So I'm going to try to hit the highlights, but I invite you to ask questions and dig deeper into the document because there's an awful lot of good stuff in it. So just to recap the background, the reason that we have a national broadband plan now is as a result of the activity by Congress about a year and a half ago to adopt the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, also known as the stimulus bill. Specifically, Section 6001K directed the FCC to come up with a national broadband plan to address these essential criteria. Promoting broadband, and especially take a look at the third bullet there. What they specifically wanted, what Congress specifically wanted the FCC to do is not talk about broadband in the abstract, but talk about its real-world impact on essential services to the American public, like education, healthcare, energy, public safety. So the FCC did, in fact, put together this tome. It turned out to be about 340 pages long, with 203 official recommendations, many exhibits and appendices. There was a rumor that the FCC had about 300 staff people working on this document. It took them about a year to come out with it, on which they did on March 16th earlier this year. Now, before getting into the specific recommendations, I put up here the goals of this document and what it was trying to achieve. Now, having said this, before I describe the goals a little bit more closely, I will say that Blair Levin, who was the lead sponsor and within the FCC, he managed the bureau that drafted this effort. His personal viewpoint is that the goals are the least important components of this entire broadband plan. But nonetheless, almost every other country has goals like this. And so it would have been a shortcoming, a failure, if the United States did not set some targets. And whether we reach these targets or not, I think personally it is important for us to have something that we're going to try to achieve, some way that we can measure our progress. Hopefully we can achieve these goals even more quickly. But most of these goals were established, the goal was set by the year 2020. Which is obviously a little less than 10 years away. I think that's a long-term horizon on which to base the United States policy. Much better would have been to establish goals by the year 2015, in my opinion. But nonetheless, don't let that distract you. It's a very, very aggressive document proposing a whole host of changes. And it could be that the 2020 timeframe is more recognition of the work that needs to be done in order to turn the regulatory process around to achieve them. So as you can see, the first goal focuses on residential access. That's the most talked about form of broadband goals, to increase the level of speed to the home. But that's not the only one. Mobile is certainly increasingly important given the rapid adoption of mobile technology. There was an emphasis on making that access not just available but also affordable. So there are many recommendations in the plan in order to increase competition and that will help reduce prices and also to increase the subsidies for low-income Americans. The fourth goal is a particularly important one to this audience and to the work that I do because it's specifically focused on the needs of anchor institutions. So the schools, the libraries, the community colleges, the health care facilities, the colleges and universities, government buildings, these are institutions that require a different kind or different quality of broadband access than residential consumers. So I and EDUCAUSE and Internet2 and others, part of a group called the Schools, Health, and Libraries Broadband Coalition, lobbied very aggressively for the inclusion of this goal, because we did not want the overwhelming support for residential broadband to negate the fact or overlook the fact that community anchor institutions also need broadband. Even if they already have a minimal level of broadband today, oftentimes that level of broadband is simply not sufficient for the long-term future. So we're very pleased that this is identified as a specific goal. And then, of course, public safety, energy, are also very important goals. It's kind of odd that energy was reduced to allowing Americans to track their broadband, their energy consumption over broadband. You would have thought that would have been a little bit broader goal than just that, but I think you see that in the rest of the document. Now, here is the outline of the National Broadband Plan in the different chapters in the report and the different recommendations in each chapter. So a couple of things to notice. First, there is a specific chapter on education. And not only did they include education as a specific set of goals, but there are more recommendations in the education chapter than in any other chapter in the whole report. Now, when I first looked at this scheme, I thought, well, implementation seems to be kind of short on the list of recommendations here. And that gave me a little bit of concern, because we didn't want this document just to say, hey, here's what the goal should be, and no follow-through on what we should do in order to achieve that. So I was very pleased to see then a side-by-side document released the set of proceedings that the FCC was going to look at actually implement these goals. So I thought this was pretty good. And then I was even more pleased when the list kept going with additional proceedings. And so that was very comforting to me to say that this is not just a theory. This is not just a broadband plan in the air, that they're actually going to try to take steps to implement this. So let's move to the specific recommendations. Oh, I'm sorry. No, there are some additional regulatory proceedings here. A third page of regulatory proceedings. I think that was all. No, it wasn't, actually. There's another fourth page of regulatory proceedings. So it looks like they do have a lot of work to do. I'm wondering, oh, there's a fifth page, too. So that's kind of, for me, as an attorney in Washington, this could not get any better. This is a whole lot of work for regulatory counsel and attorneys and consultants. But it does give you, doesn't it, the impression that, holy cow, there's an awful lot of work to do to turn the bus around, to make our broadband policies start to go in the right direction here in order to achieve these goals. The problem is that we've had a regulatory regime that was really focused on telephone service and has not been thinking about the future. Finally, we have now a plan that we can get our hands around that thinks about the future, but the implementation of this is going to be a bear. And now I understand even more than before why the year 2020 was set out as a goal, because each one of these proceedings could take years to implement. But that's not all, because you noticed on all of these documents there's a little star next to the agenda items, and when you read the fine print in the FCC plan, the star says this isn't all of the proceedings. This doesn't fully count all of them that need to be done. There are some that started before this plan, and in fact, the 63 regulatory proceedings that the FCC identified, think of this, half of the recommendations coming out of the National Broadband Plan are within the FCC's jurisdiction. That's the 63. The other half of the recommendations have to do with other government agencies and things that they need to do in order to make this plan work. So there's a huge amount of work to do. I'm going to try to hit on some of these. As I said before, I can't possibly hit them all because there are so many, but I just want to try to highlight some. So on infrastructure, what is the goal? Well, one of the biggest reasons for the United States falling in our broadband capabilities is the high costs of deploying broadband. Also, a fundamental underpinning of the entire report is that even though the stimulus bill authorized $7.2 billion in spending on the BTOP program and the BIP program to subsidize broadband infrastructure, the majority of investment in this country for broadband is going to occur by the private sector. The government doesn't have the resources to build broadband everywhere. So what the government can do is try to make that broadband investment happen more efficiently, try to create the conditions that allow more private sector investment. One of the ways of doing this is taking some actions to reduce the pole attachment fees, which can be up to 20% of the cost of deploying a fiber network, can be just in what you pay to string the fiber along the telephone poles. There are also things that you can do to make the rights of way more available and to build rights of way along transportation projects. There's also an awful interesting disparity, and this doesn't make any sense, but this is one of the reasons why we need these regulatory changes. You pay a different amount to attach your fiber to the poles depending on who you are, even if it's the same fiber and it's the same pole. Right now, if you're a cable company, you get a cheaper rate than if you're a phone company or if you're an incumbent local exchange carrier. So the FCC is now looking at how to harmonize those rates and reduce the costs for the phone companies so they get equivalent of the cable rate. That would hopefully encourage more phone companies to deploy broadband and fiber more quickly. On spectrum, a huge number of recommendations here. The primary one is to try to make more spectrum available because we're dealing with a short supply of spectrum. And so there are more and more services coming out, as we can tell from, you know, the problems AT&T has had with its iPhone. You know, there's not enough spectrum out there right now to handle all the growing emerging applications. So this report was very aggressive and said we need 500 megahertz of new spectrum. And, in fact, recommended specifically taking 120 megahertz away from the commercial broadcasters. Well, that is not going to be easy, as you can imagine. The broadcasters are very upset about this. But yet, there is an argument that the world is changing and that you get more of your broadcast TV now over cable systems or over the Internet. And so why are the broadcasters sitting on this very valuable spectrum that could much more efficiently be used for mobile technologies? So they've created a spectrum dashboard, which is kind of interesting. For the first time, the FCC is going to allow each one of us to go to the website and find out who's licensed to use a particular piece of spectrum, how they're using it, and also available to find vacant spectrum. So if you're a researcher and you're trying to find a new innovative technology, you could go to that dashboard yourself and try to find a piece of spectrum that you could use in order to develop that innovative use. Interesting on spectrum fees. This is another economic concept that has already been implemented in the UK, where government and commercial users now have to pay an annual fee based on the amount of spectrum that they use. And this is kind of the purpose here is not to raise money for the government. The purpose is to encourage more efficient use of the spectrum. And so now what's already going on is you see companies and the government now building into their case, okay, we're going to have to pay this much if we continue to use the spectrum. Hopefully the goal is that some of these existing users will realize that it's too expensive and that they'll turn that spectrum back into the government to be reallocated for more uses. The white spaces proceeding is a small piece but is potentially a significant one. The FCC has just adopted a new order to allow unlicensed devices to use the spectrum not used by the broadcasters today. So that could be very valuable. Wendy spent a lot of time, actually we didn't talk about this. I don't know if you want to mention that in your comments.
If there are questions, I'd be glad to answer.
All right, but that could be a significant one that the FCC just achieved. This is a Cisco study that documents the growth in mobile data traffic. I think this is self-evident to anybody given the current marketplace. But as you can see, it's not expected to stabilize or to flatten out. This growth curve is expected, if anything, to accelerate. And that's why we need more spectrum. Research and development received some attention from the broadband plan as well. There were some recommendations on the R&E tax credit and long-term research. Interesting recommendation to build more broadband to Department of Defense installations as a way to kind of prove the technology and that you could build off from that to serve the neighboring community and other recommendations there. Broadband availability. This section mainly had to do with the Universal Service Fund. This is a prime example of how old policy needs to be replaced with new policy. The old Universal Service Fund, or the current Universal Service Fund is actually also an old Universal Service Fund. It's up to about almost $9 billion per year that every one of us pays on our telephone bills today, a little surcharge that's right now about 15% of your long-distance phone bill is paid to this Universal Service Fund, and it has traditionally supported rural phone companies and the E-rate program. Most of those rural phone companies use it to provide telephone service. Well, that's not right for the future. That's not 21st century kind of thinking. So the FCC explicitly said, let's create a new Connect America fund and a new mobility fund in order to subsidize future technologies, not the old technologies. Wendy's going to talk about one of the other key recommendations here was to that the FCC put forth was to create a unified community anchor network, which I think is a really good idea based on, again, the needs for anchor institutions for very high-capacity broadband. 100 megabits, 1 gigabit is the kind of goals that we should have for anchor institutions. The best way to achieve that, of course, is through aggregating traffic and putting allowing different kind of entities to share their resources and put their traffic on the same pipes. That becomes a more efficient way of doing that. The FCC also recommended changing the how you collect that money. Right now, I said it's a 15% charge on your phone bill, but the problem is it's only on your long-distance phone bill, and, of course, long-distance chargers have come way down. That current way of collecting universal service funds is not sustainable. However, the problem is going to be if you shift to a different method, that could force some people to pay into the fund who are not paying today. And one of the options, for instance, is IP traffic. As that becomes a substitute for voice telephone service, does that open the door for the FCC to start assessing fees on Internet usage? It's going to be an interesting question to see how that's resolved next year. Now, the FCC and Blair Levin specifically identified for residential consumers a target of 4 megabits per second. He's taken a lot of criticism for that, and the plan is taking criticism for not being forward-thinking enough with regard to residential consumers. But this is the chart that they used to justify why 4 megabits was the right standard, because it basically allows a single streamed standard definition classroom lecture as an example of what you could do over a 4 megabit connection. Others have said that's way too small. We ought to be thinking in terms of higher bandwidth. And Blair Levin's response has been, well, yes, we do want, of course we want much higher bandwidth available to everybody, but that's not the question. The question is how much should the government subsidize? What's the bare minimum that we should spend all of our money on trying to subsidize to make sure everybody has this as a minimum level? And in that score, he compared the United States, this 4 megabits target, to other targets adopted in other countries, which are, in the view of the broadband plan, was a much lower target, you know, 1 megabit or even less than that. Of course, most of these other countries were thinking about their goals of 2008 through 2010, not 2020. So I think still the question is out there, what should our goal for residential access be by 2020? Is 4 megabits going to be enough to get us to where we want to be? Adoption and use received, as I mentioned, a lot of important recommendations to make broadband more affordable. They also focused on a national digital literacy core, which is kind of interesting, kind of like the AmeriCorps concept. Of getting volunteers to go out and train people about how to use the computers, particularly for older Americans who don't have that familiarity with the technology. So this is going to receive a lot of work going forward as well. Now, on the education, there were several recommendations here for things the Department of Education should do. Now, open license public domain software, award grants to train teachers in digital literacy, standards for electronic educational records. This is, I'm just pulling out a few of these. There are actually many, many recommendations for the Department of Education. Of course, the question is how many of these is the Department of Education actually going to do? You know, these are good ideas, but it takes an awful lot of effort and coordination in order to get that done. So there's more work to be done here. But this is why the FCC thought it was necessary, because usually this kind of charts show our broadband rankings, United States broadband rankings compared to the rest of the world. This chart actually shows our educational rankings compared to the rest of the world and how we're lagging behind many other OECD countries. And the counter that with this experience at Carnegie Mellon, which showed really amazing, interesting results from students using online learning, that they're learning just as much, if not better, through online courses with less hours involved, and they're more likely to actually complete their studies if they're using online educational materials. So it's a very promising results from that experience, and leads you naturally to think, yes, broadband can be influential in helping our educational process. Now, the FCC also, one thing they have done is to increase or make some changes to the E-rate program for schools and libraries. I won't go through all of the changes, but they did just adopt an order to try to modernize that program. They explicitly allow E-rate to be used for broadband, which is a good thing. And they also give more flexibility for schools and libraries to use the dark fiber and lit fiber services provided by state research and education networks, which is a huge new development. In the past, the E-rate program was primarily essentially biased toward the commercial carriers. And schools and libraries often took service from a phone company or cable company because they could get E-rate support for that, even if the local R&E network or the municipality was cheaper, but because they couldn't participate in the E-rate program. So over the long run, I think this is a very positive change. It's actually going to mean better quality broadband for schools and libraries at cheaper prices. And that helps government efficiency, too. It should reduce the draw on the Universal Service Fund. Some additional recommendations on E-rate reforms, particularly the last one here, is interesting. They recommended that Congress amend E-rate to allow community colleges to participate in the program. Right now, the E-rate program is limited to schools and libraries, not community colleges. And that's by statute. The problem is that any time the FCC recommends that Congress make changes to appropriate more money, it's almost like a kiss of death in this current fiscal environment. It's going to be very difficult for this Congress to do that. But nonetheless, it is on the table. It is something that if the community colleges want to succeed in achieving this, this is a big help to them that the FCC has made this recommendation. So that's a very broad view of what has happened so far. There's as I mentioned, with the regulatory proceedings that the FCC is currently engaged in, there's also a separate process now within the Obama administration to consider the other 50% of the National Broadband Plan recommendations. There's a task force that's been created, chaired by Larry Strickling at NTIA and Scott Harris at the Department of Energy, and they're reviewing the broadband plan recommendations for the other executive branch agencies. They're going to try to whip them into shape and decide which of these recommendations to try to really follow through on and implement. So that is also going to be an ongoing process, and one in which they have already asked us to be involved in. So all of you who have ideas, as you read through the report, listen to this presentation and others, if you have ideas, please feed them to us, because they are asking us for our input on what the priorities should be going forward. Just a last point, what about net neutrality? Big issue. It's not in the broadband plan. It was treated on a separate track. And so I don't want you to think that we've forgotten about it or neglected it. It's a vitally important issue, but the FCC said we've got to try to move the net neutrality is so hot, so controversial. They wanted the broadband plan to focus on the broadband implementation goals, but the FCC is working towards a net neutrality decision perhaps by early next year. They're taking another round of comment right now on wireless services, whether net neutrality should apply to wireless, and how to deal with a category called specialized services. Happy to tell you more about that in the Q&A period. But, of course, the midterm elections will have a big impact on that, because many of the Republicans and some Democrats in Congress are very concerned that imposing net neutrality could, this is the industry point, could delay their ability to invest in broadband and slow economic growth. Not sure that that's a real-world scenario, but that is the argument that's being made, and so it's a very touchy political hot button right now. So with that, I'll close, and thank you very much for your attention. Turn over to Wendy.
Good morning. It's wonderful to see so many people attend and interested in broadband and the National Broadband Plan. We've been talking about this for, you know, at least 10 years, and the policy office in D.C. was very gratified, along with, believe it or not, most bipartisan accomplishment so far, I think, of the Obama administration. Blair Levin did an amazing thing of threading a needle here and not offending too many people on either side, and came up with a national broadband plan that generally has been very, very well received. I'm Wendy Wiggin, and I'm a government relations officer in the EDUCAUSE D.C. office. I've worked extensively with John and others on the National Broadband Plan, and we thought today that we'd drill down on one specific aspect of the National Broadband Plan, the UCAN project, which we feel will have probably the most direct impact immediately on the higher education community. So kind of give you an example of how that's moving forward, how it originated. Gary Bahula, who has been the acting lead on the UCAN project, Internet 2, was invited to give this talk, and as of yesterday, he was still giving this talk, and then he got called to an important meeting regarding UCAN, and when the NTIA calls, you go. And so he called, and I am filling in. So if this is a little rough, it's because it's Gary's slides, and I've looked at them this morning, and, you know, hopefully I'll get through this just fine, and we can handle things in the Q&A between John and I. What I'd like to cover briefly on UCAN is, number one, how it fits into the National Broadband Plan. John did an excellent job of describing how broad-based the National Broadband Plan is and how UCAN then fits in to that, you know, massive program of implementing going forward. Also, we'll talk a little bit about the implementation. What has happened so far? Where is the project? Are we moving forward? Is it being funded? You know, how are we going to do this? USUCAN is also more than just building a network. It is the organization. It is the idea of how do we get all these anchor institutions together. So we'll talk a little bit about that. And if I have time, we'll talk some about the ongoing funding, which, of course, whenever you've got a project of this magnitude, the concern for funding is ongoing as well. In the National Broadband Plan, and I'm not going to read this to you, but we did want to point out that actual, if you had the plan in your hand, page 154, 155, it does state on recommendation, it was chapter 8, recommendation number 22, and that an institutional framework, that the state governments and the federal government should develop a framework that will help America's anchor institutions obtain broadband connectivity training, applications and services. So it established the fact that this was a job of the government, both federal and state, to look at connectivity for anchor institutions. And we'll get to the definition of anchor institutions in a moment. It then went on to suggest how this should occur, and it suggested one approach. Now, that means there are many possible approaches, but one approach to how we can improve broadband for anchor institutions is to give a nonprofit institution the mission and capability to focus on serving the broadband needs of public institutions. Now, what are anchor institutions? Those include health clinics, community colleges, schools, community centers, libraries, museums, and other public access points. And, of course, universities, both private and public, are included in that. Where do we get that definition? That definition goes back to the ARRA legislation, the Stimulus Act, where it was spelled out what constitutes an anchor institution. Okay, so now they said they should have this nonprofit organization that could serve anchor institutions' broadband needs. And then they went on to say, well, you know, we know of some that already exist. Nonprofit research and education networks, and of course we help them understand these nonprofit research and education networks, and the fact that higher ed's been doing this for a while. Higher ed has had a nonprofit organization that has helped fill the need for high-speed broadband originally for research universities, but that has expanded out from that. Its mission has gradually expanded to meet the needs of over 66,000 community anchor institutions that go well beyond the needs of just college and university and particular research institutions. This model has worked well. It has been scalable. It has been sustainable. And we went to the FCC, and they agreed. In fact, at one point early on in a meeting, I knew we were making progress when Blair Levin, who was in charge of the entire process, looked at John and I and said, you know, if there wasn't an Internet too, we'd have to develop one. He said the needs of anchor institutions that they uncovered in their research for the National Broadband Plan showed that the real market failures may not be in the residential market. The real market failures of broadband deployment may lay with the anchor institutions, that the institutional broadband is where we're really lagging and we aren't seeming to be able to fill the needs through the private sector. We walked out of the meeting somewhat shifting our focus, because we had also really been beating the drum for residential broadband access, and we said, you know, they had some very convincing points. Perhaps we should shift our focus and really focus on anchor institutions. And EDUCAUSE, along, as John stated, many other organizations concerned with anchor institutions, really switched our lobbying, if you want to call it that, our advocacy, to getting support for anchor institutions. And we're very gratified. We think we've made a tremendous amount of progress. And a lot of it was because we had this model to point to. We had the model of RNE networks at the local level, state level, and at the national level. So what is the networking model? What is the RNE networking model? These are the features that we emphasized and that the federal government were very impressed with. That model, it's an advanced network tailored to the specific needs of users, and that's what they found was lacking so often in institutional connectivity. High capacity, uncongested, transparent. All of you are very familiar with this. I don't need to go through all the details. But this is very important, that second point. Price to encourage, not discourage, new use, new applications, and growth. And the federal government is looking at the problems within healthcare and the problems within education and the problems within energy, and they're saying what we need is some innovative new applications that use the technology that help solve these issues. That is where the Obama administration comes down on broadband. It is how can we solve all these various societal issues? And they look at these networking model that the RNE networks have put together and how those already serve many anchor institutions, and they're going, all right, how can we make this better? How can we expand this? How can we use this to solve these various issues? The networks are primarily owned, controlled, directed by their users. There's three tiers of networks, as you know, at the national level, regional, state level, the local level. They are nonprofit. They are public purpose. And the final point here, and Gary wanted me to especially emphasize this, and what Internet 2 is emphasizing, NLR is emphasizing, the other are regional and educational networks, are saying what really makes us stand out from the private providers is not our network, so to speak, but it's our community that we build that help people use the technology and use the network. And so this is a very vital and perhaps the most complex and difficult part of this whole venture. The technology, we know how to do that. We know how to lay down fiber. We know how to connect institutions. How do we get those institutions to be able to maximize the use of that connectivity? RNE networking, where are we at today? Well, we have two main national networks, Internet 2 and National Lambda Rail, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. At the regional and state level, we're at more than 36, but these are the 36 that are very active in the state and regional community. And you can see probably the one that your institution deals with up here. And then we have the anchor institutions themselves. And in part of all our advocacy, we were asked to come up with numbers. All right, don't just tell us there's a lot of anchor institutions out there. We want to know how many there are, how many are being served. And so just to give you some idea, these are the 66,000 anchor institutions that are currently being served today by R&E networks. And you can see they go all the way across the board from colleges and universities down to public media, science centers, zoos, aquarium, and everything in between. A vital part of that is the K-12 school districts, the K-12 schools. You can see the number that they're already serving. So even though R&E networks grew out of the higher ed and the research movement to get more broadband, they already are well on their way to being a thoroughly an anchor institution organization. Average bit rate, 108.8 megabits, median bit rate, 12. Now you can tell from that that some of these institutions have tremendous bandwidth that really skews that average bit rate. So the median is probably more telling when you're looking at what is the job put out ahead of us. They call for 1 gigabit to anchor institutions. Our median is now at 12 megabits. We've got some growing to do, even though we have the networks in place. So how do we implement UCAN? Number one, what we all need to implement any program is money. Where are we going to get the money? We hear about the federal budget and the stimulus program, and we hear about a government that is in the red. Where are we going to get money to implement UCAN? Probably the number one question that we get. Well, it just happened that part of ARRA, not only the Recovery Act, not only asked them to develop a national broadband plan, but there was this other little program that we had advocated for and we'd fought for years, and that was money, stimulus grants, to go out to broadband. And I very vividly remember us marching around on the Hill telling them, if you're going to have a stimulus plan for infrastructure, you've got to include broadband. And Nancy Pelosi was saying, we would not, if you can remember back 2 years ago, we will not have another stimulus plan unless it is developed around infrastructure. And we went into her office and we said, if you're going to do infrastructure, you've got to do broadband. And that was one of our early wins. She announced that there would be no stimulus plan without money for broadband. And there you have it. It happened. Must be nice to have that kind of power. And the program just wound down as far as the initial phase of awarding grants on September 30th. They met their deadline that all monies had to be awarded by September 30th. And here is pretty much the outcome of that. They did a summary. There was 233 projects, US UCAN being one of them, that was funded. And the goal here of those projects, and this is coming from the project descriptions, they will install or upgrade over 120,000 miles of broadband networks. And these are the anchor institutions that it will be serving, 24,000 anchor institutions. So we're looking at 66 that are connected now. We add that 24,000, we'll be up to about 40% of the total number of anchor institutions in this country, from our best estimate. So we'll be hitting about 40% if all these projects are completed, come to pass, and are able to fulfill their promises. But you can look at basically how it's distributed across the various institutions. So let's talk about the US UCAN. US UCAN, a $96 million project. $62 million of that came out of the BTOP grant program. So you can see there's some matching funds that were required there. The partners in the UCAN project are Internet 2, National Lambda Rail, Northern Tier, Indiana, and you can see the rest there. There are also some private sector partners. What's their initial goal? What was their goal and their proposal? And that was to tie together all the local and regional BTOP projects on a national backbone. And it would connect all those 66,000 anchor institutions already connected and the additional ones that are brought in by the BTOP. Long-term goal is to connect every anchor institution in the United States. Where did we come up with 200,000? And just briefly, this is kind of the little inventory that Internet 2 and so their partners put together as to how many anchor institutions do we really have? And, of course, that's going to vary. It's like when you start talking about public safety, does that mean every car, every police car is an anchor institution, or does it just mean the police station? Does it mean every substation? There's lots of complications here on defining it, but this is the number they arrived at. The feds like that number. They're using that number. Of course, when all is said and done, it may vary from that quite a bit. What are we talking about as far as the network? This is the network that UCAN proposes to complete. And, of course, this is the national network. This combines the infrastructure of Internet 2, of NLR, and of Northern Tier, the green, which will be completed using the UCAN project. And it will be upgraded. We're looking at a massive upgrade. It's going to move it from an average of 10 gigabit speed on the national backbone up to 100 gigabits. So the benefit, direct benefit to our universities right off the bat of the UCAN project, before it even reaches out to anything beyond the university community, is that your bandwidth is going to be upgraded to 100 gigabits that is available over these national networks. And basically the federal money is what's paying for it. So it's basically, if it doesn't connect all those anchor institutions, if it just connects who is on Internet 2 and NLR today, they still will have a massive upgrade, which the members did not have to pay a significant amount to get that upgrade. So number one benefit. Next steps, and then I think I'll stop there and we'll take some questions. Upgrading and extending the backbone network is the first step. Partnering with the regional R&E network, so a lot of politics involved here. This is pulling the whole community together, getting the, and you know, as we all know, the R&E networks have developed in isolation in many cases. They're all not always known as working real well together, as sometimes that politically in D.C., I would not understand that when people can't get along. Partnering with other anchor institution networks, including municipal, so you can see this is, it will develop broader and broader reaching into the local area. Establishing and ensuring the success of an anchor institution user organization, so not just getting connectivity, helping them know how to use it, helping them know how to connect, helping them use all the applications, helping them have the bandwidth capability that they can create their own innovative applications. And, of course, longer term, reaching all the anchor institutions, all the rest of the anchor institutions, and providing necessary services. Okay. I could go into usucan.org, but I think due to lack of time, I'll just tell you that there is another organization as a part of UCAN.org. It's called UCAN.org, and that really is the people part of this project. This is pulling all the people together from all these different communities, the K-12 community, the healthcare community, the public television community, and getting them to sit down and talk about what their needs are and help guide the UCAN project to where it can be of the maximum use for its end users. Who are those projects, who are those groups that are now already talking, and we have been talking with them for well over a year? You see EDUCAUSE there, of course, Internet 2 and NLR are very actively involved in this. But these are the end user communities. Just to give you, the acronyms, the alphabet soup here, you have ISTE and COSIN, which is the K-12 technology professionals, ALA, American Library Association, Association of Community Colleges, the healthcare industry is the next one. NENA is public service. NATOA is municipalities. And, of course, EDUCAUSE representing the higher ed group. So at that, I think I'll open it up to questions before we totally run out of time. And questions for John or questions for I. Gary Bahula or myself are both, if you have questions about the UCAN project and how it develops, just go ahead and get a hold of me at EDUCAUSE or Gary Bahula at Internet 2, and I'll put up his contact information, which is at the end here. There we go. If you have further questions on this particular project. So, questions. Way in the back. Jim.
Yeah. What do you see as the future beyond VTOC? Because some of our states got nothing at all. And there are states where we have universities that have 50 megabit connections. like a homeless person in Tokyo.
Right.
So what do you see as the future beyond VTOP to bring back to the states that, for whatever reason, Commerce didn't want to fund?
John, do you want to take that one, or do you want me to take that?
Well, we can both chime in, Wendy.
Okay.
First, I'm surprised to hear you say that your state did not receive anything, because the statute says that every state...
They got a couple of PCC awards,
okay.
$2 million, and one corner for one county got an infrastructure award.
Okay.
So
okay.
$50 million for the whole state.
I see. And what state are we talking about?
South Carolina.
Okay.
Yep.
All the politics were working against them, it sounds like. Yeah.
And two proposals were submitted. You know, all of the things. So what is the future where we can get to some of these places for whatever reason didn't get anything?
Well, I don't have great news for you, because from our conversations with the Obama administration, they have been telling us that right now they cannot go to OMB and ask for further congressional appropriations until they've exhausted every possible regulatory change that they can try to achieve in order to promote more private sector investment. So for the short run, I think the focus is going to be making the BTOP grant winners show that they are successful, and then perhaps there will be a track record upon which we can then make a case that Congress should go back and authorize more funding. But I think we're probably a year or two away from being able to prove that, because we need to gather some evidence of the success of the projects that have been awarded so far. Now, the broadband plan that I talked about is proposing many of these regulatory changes, and the change to the E-rate program could be useful in order to encourage more state, regional, local, municipal networks to get involved. But there's unfortunately not going to be a silver bullet here. I think the broadband plan is going, it's really a great step in the right direction, but it's going to take a few years in order to actually be implemented, and you'll start seeing the results.
I'd like to add to that. One part of our advocacy early on in the BTOP program, and I think we had a great deal of success of kind of changing the focus and really actually focusing the program on anchor institutions, was the fact that if you focus on getting connectivity out into these areas that maybe have a public library, or they have a town hall, or they have a healthcare clinic, and you get the fiber out to these anchor institutions, and then at that point you are bringing connectivity into the community, it is available, they can set up access points there, and also it's on an open basis. Now that is yet to be worked out, the detail on that, but it was with the idea that a local provider then could tie into that anchor network to provide access to the internet for, say, a wireless network that they could set up. The backhaul, from what our understanding is, the backhaul in the middle mile has always been the most expensive part for these isolated communities. They could get enough local commitment to build, say, a small network in their area, but they couldn't afford to pay to get it out to the internet. And so one of the reasons that UCAN was adopted is the idea that by building to the anchor institutions using some government funding, using a project like UCAN, that then you've taken care of that middle mile cost, and so hopefully the local community can come up with the money and the resources to be able to get it at that last mile. So I don't know if that's of any solace, but that was the thinking. $7 billion was not enough to fund broadband to everybody's front door. But we convinced them, and I think along with a lot of other people, $7 billion is enough to get it out into the community. And once it's in the community, then use the community resources to get it to the front door. Okay. Long answer.
I believe we've run out of time. There are online evaluations of the session. Will you hang around?
Yes, I'll be here. I have a few minutes. I can be here, and John can be here as we're switching and letting the next presenters come in. If you have questions, come right on up.
Thank you for your work.
Thank you.